Our guest today is building his business as an incredible podcasting coach. He's been around the world of online business, web design, and podcasting for 20 plus years, so he has a ton of wisdom to share. And we talk about the biggest and second biggest mistakes that podcasters make when trying to make a show that's sustainable. And he's not wrong. I've definitely made both of these mistakes. We also learn the five ways that you can monetize your podcast, or honestly, any creator platform, using his Smash framework. And of course, we get into life, parenting, learning, and content creation as well. Please welcome to interview 57, Joe Casabona. I've gotten into a really big habit. I think it's a good habit, even if it's boring for guests, but I always say thank you right at the beginning of episodes because you are an incredible creator. You support a lot of people in the industry of podcasting. You're a dad and everything else that you do. And to take time out of your day to do this really means the world. So first off, I just want to say thank you for creating with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Of course, it's an episode that I've been really looking forward to. There are many reasons why, but I love allowing people to do a self-introduction off the bat because we often have ourselves defined for us in social media. So if I were to write a definition of who you are based on my research and knowing your content, then I can say certain things that you do. But I love to allow people to introduce themselves because each day, especially for the creative types, we wake up a little bit differently. We maybe would say things slightly differently. So if I were actually working with, let's say, a high school media class, they were learning podcasting. You come in as a guest speaker and you have the opportunity to introduce yourself. Who are you and what do you do?
I love that because moments before we started recording, I tweeted, I'm already timestamping this. This is terrible. I tweeted that I would rather miss out on followers than have a one-dimensional Twitter profile. Because personality is everything, and when you try to appease an algorithm, you lose personality. So I love what you said about like, oh, maybe my intro is a little bit different. So here's the intro I'll give that is not the one that is a text expander snippet that I just paste into everything. So as you said, I'm a dad of three children, six and under, girl, boy, girl. So our house is very busy. But as a result, I knew that when I started my business as first a freelance web developer, now a podcast automations coach, I knew I had to take more stuff off of my plate as a result of having kids. And so my career from that point on has been helping people do what they want to do best and most efficiently. And again, mostly that's in the realm of podcasting. So I help people take their podcast processes and boil it down to only the things they need to do, which is usually just recording and maybe some guest outreach or maybe some social media stuff. So that is what I do in a nutshell. I'm also a huge Star Wars fan, Disney fan, and Yankees fan, though I'm having a hard time admitting that these days as they're not very good right now. And I smoke cigars. That's just about all the important stuff.
I've seen those different things from your social profiles. I really appreciate you sharing that you don't want to be a one-dimensional creator because for me, I think we all do naturally feel kind of like we're bouncing between two sides of a river when it comes to that, like how specific and, to use an annoying word sometimes, funnel driven do we stay, and how like niched down, to use another annoying term, yeah, do we stay versus how kind of wild and creative do we get that actually represents our true identities. And I find it's like a river that we bounce between those two banks. So why and or how do you feel like you are able to do that without jeopardizing success in your business?
Yeah, that's a really good question, right? Because I think that people can take my question and then the mirror version of my question, which is like, you need to niche down and focus or whatever, to either extreme, right? People hear I need to niche down. And maybe they think, okay, I can only talk about podcasting, right? But then people might hear my statement and say, like, yeah, I should appeal to everybody. Neither of those, in my personal opinion, are true, right? You definitely need to niche down your business, because when you talk to everybody, you talk to nobody, and you want to resonate with people. This is something I've really struggled with, because I felt like, well, if I niche down, I'm excluding potential customers. But what probably takes experience and doing it wrong for 20 years, I haven't been doing it wrong that I've been, a moderately successful business person for most of that time. But what you realize is that when you niche down and you really understand someone's problem is they will pay you more because they trust you implicitly. They'll be the better client, or the better student, or the better customer, or, you know, whatever niche you're in. However, that doesn't mean I'm only allowed to talk about this on social media. When I talk about solving problems, I will always do it through the lens of the busy solopreneur who has a family who wants to keep running their lifestyle business. That's really easy for me to resonate with because that is me. But that doesn't mean I'm never going to tweet about the Yankees and how they fumbled the trade deadline, right? I tweeted a picture of my oldest as Wednesday Adams today because she is obsessed. And I thought, wow, she looks like really good early Halloween costume or whatever, right? So I think that I will always let my personality shine on social media because people should know who they're working with. But when it comes to my marketing copy, you know, I'm probably not going to say, I'm a podcaster and also a Yankees fan, so don't work with me, Red Sox fans, or whatever. So, it's striking that balance. I think on social media, where it is social, or on your personal website, definitely let your personality shine through and talk about things that interest you. Mm-hmm. And then when you are talking about solving problems, that's when you really want to think about who is my target audience, who is in my niche.
Yeah, I don't think there's any truly fully right way, but at least in my opinion, you strike the perfect balance because it's quite evident that your expertise is in podcasting that initially drew me to your content, but the fact that you are sort of a normal person is what allows me to appreciate wanting to create with you. There are so many like accounts that are like the podcasting guy or the mini mall guy or the car guy. And it's like, I could care less really about following their overall content. Even if they have a whole bunch of great advice, it's not interesting to me as somebody who likes creating with people. And I'll share one other quick story. When I first got into content creation myself, it was more in video. I thought I wanted to be the classic YouTuber. Mm-hmm. And I was struggling because I had a camera. I was like, I wanted to create like Casey Neistat, but I wasn't making anything happen. Like a lot of podcasters talk about, I had the gear and months went by without making anything. So I was like, okay, I need to force myself to get over this. How could I do it? I told/asked my wife permission. Anyways, I went to New York City, drove there by myself, middle of the night, woke up, got on Instagram, did 4 collaborations with 4 different people in about just under 48 hours, got in my car and drove back home. But at dinner the first night with a guy who's a hip hop artist and does a lot of like teaching dance and some different things, mm-hmm. has a pretty big brand, super nice guy. He was like, yo, I thought at first when you reached out that you were like a serial killer or something. And then I saw your posts with you and your daughter. And that's when I DM'd you back.
Yeah.
And that stood out to me as, oh, never thought of that aspect of it. But he was like, that's when I recognized, oh, this is a real person. And I was like, yeah, sure. Let's go make some stuff together. And from that moment on, I tried to figure out that balance. And I guess it'll be one of those infinite games like podcasting that we can just always get better at. So I really appreciate that. You mentioned being a solopreneur, and you said the term lifestyle business. When I host these interviews, a lot of times I'm putting myself in the shoes or mind of people who may not even know these terms. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious how you define lifestyle business.
Yeah, great question, right? And this is like, it's funny because I said the word solopreneur to my brother, Robbie, who works at Disney World. He's always had a corporate job. He's like, what's a solopreneur? And I'm like, well, it's you smash the word solo and entrepreneur together and that's what you get. lifestyle business to me, right? And this is like, I've never really looked up the definition. I've just kind of used it based on context, is having a business that allows me the freedom to do what I want when I want, right? And so my kids have a game or a play or whatever, some school event in the middle of the afternoon. A lifestyle business allows me to go to that without having to ask somebody for permission to do it, right? Or it allows me, you know, my brother lives in upstate New York. We just got home from vacation and we are going to visit him for a few days early next week, right? I don't have to worry about vacation days or am I hustling enough? I just go and I do that because it would be fun and we haven't seen his house and he lives up near Lake George, which is amazing this time of year. So
it's cool.
Yeah.
I can only assume you've learned at least some things, but you never know. The internet's big. But from Pat Flynn, like, you're familiar with Smart Passive Income, Pat mm-hmm. Flynn, and like him yeah. as a creator?
Yeah. Yeah. I was, I've actually been on Ask Pat 2.0 a couple of times, which is cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's something that I thought would be really interesting too. And I've followed his work for quite a while. The only reason I ask is because, you know, you guys have a lot of in common, right? Mm-hmm. And so, whether that's somewhat coincidental or kind of overlap, I feel like that's something for me that I've always looked up to in him as a creator and extremely successful business owner now is, you know, one of the things I remember him saying years ago was that when he set out to start a business, it was so that he could like pick up and drop off his kids and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I do a lot of traditional educational work from September to June.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, in the summer, I get to experience a lot of that. Like this week, I've been working on my newsletter, creating podcast episodes, and really head down focused. But, you know, I was eating breakfast with my daughters just a few hours ago. And right after this, I'll go pick them up. And that's definitely where I aspire to head to. When you think of, I know we'll get into podcasting specifically, but when you think of lifestyle business and creating that, what are some insights or tips that you would give people who now know the definition and are like, shit, that sounds good. How do I do it?
Yeah, I think this is a really important question. The first question / hurdle you need to overcome is, how am I going to support myself, right? People have said, Joe, you've always had the entrepreneurial spirit, right? I started my first business as a freelance web developer when I was 13 or 14, something like that. Before that, when we had yard sales, I would try to turn a profit on my toys, not realizing that my parents bought all of them. So it was pure profit for me. But, you know, I was always scheming. I tell people I was like a realistic Zach Morris. Like I wasn't like renting out the school parking lot to car dealers on the weekend, but I was making mix CDs for people and guaranteeing 2-day delivery because we had a dedicated internet line. So I could just leave Napster up all night to download the songs and then rip the CDs in the morning. After high school and college, though, it gets real, right? You have a mortgage, you have a family. I left. I did have a couple of traditional full-time jobs in my mid-20s. And I decided to leave my agency job with a 3-month-old at home and my wife on approaching unpaid maternity leave. Right. Mm-hmm. So I had to really be sure that I could support my family. And so the first thing you need to do is think about how you're going to make money and who you're going to help. Whose problems are you going to solve? Right. Which maybe this starts off as a side hustle at first, put some feelers out there on social media, develop a skill that is marketable. And that's all hand wavy and it sounds, but that's going to be different for each person.
Right.
I used to tell them like, what's something that you loved? I used to tell my friends in college, they're like, I don't have any money. I'm like, well, what's something that you like to do? You could probably make that a marketable skill. And so I'm less bullish on turn your hobby into a business now. I have a few hobbies that I would never turn into a business because I want to have some hobbies, like playing the drums. But once you figure that out, right, then it's about why are you starting the business? If it's to make millions, then you're probably going to have to work super long hours and do the hustle and work weekends, right? I've never prescribed to that. Like, that is the opposite of everything in me, because I've been talking for a long time now, right? So I'll sum this up, and then I can get to this story about my dad later, if it makes sense. Sure. But if you want to start a lifestyle business, you need to think about how much money you need to make and then how you can achieve that within the confines of the other stuff you want to do, right? So some people live to work. You're working to live. And so what are some of the non-negotiables? I need to be able to knock off of work to support my children and my family when needed. That's a non-negotiable for me. So what does that look like? How many hours do I have to work? What systems for passive income do I need to put in place? And once you work all of those out, it's probably going to be trial and error. Then you kind of know what your lifestyle business is going to look like.
I love it. And it's really interesting because I'm coming off of back-to-back recordings right now where one person is aspiring to those billionaire dreams, and we're now having a conversation about focusing on the lifestyle that it creates and what number that might be. And you said it right at the top of your answer that it's going to be an individual situation for each person, at the risk of always sounding like, hey, everything's individualized and we can just answer that to every question. I think it's important to point out that, again, nobody's wrong. I personally fall in a very similar category to yourself. And for a long time, I wondered if it was more like a money mindset and money block thing. And that was when I was kind of hanging around some people that had been guests on the show who are like life coaches. And some of them charge like $50,000 a client. And it's wild to think about. And then you hear some of them talk, like a Rich Litvin, for example, and I think he charges $100,000 a client. And it's like, you know, it's like, oh, okay, once I remove my money blocks, maybe I can get there. Or you see the masterminds where people are charging like $3,000 for someone to take their course. Mm-hmm. And when you first start in the world of online business, you kind of have this feeling of like, what is right and what is wrong? And now I've really fallen far more into a category of like, they could both work. It's true that there's probably a price point for every client and those types of things. But then I'm like, wait a second. Someone like Alex Hormozi sold his book for 99 cents, maybe a good marketing move, but also the book only costs 99 cents and it's a full great book. And one of the quotes that I love from him is that I don't need everybody's money. I don't even need a lot of people's money. I just need some of it for my personal goals. And then I'm like, oh, wait, yeah, it can work both ways. And so for me personally, it's still this journey, like you said, trial and error, figuring things out. I definitely fall into the group of, for me, because I actually love my job and have more of a fear of success, I'm like the side hustle mode, yeah, which has been so fun because it allows for patience, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was different for a long time. Before I met my wife, I would say, I don't care if I'm married by the time I'm 30. I just want to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30. Mm-hmm. And I met my wife. And, you know, I said that because I was, my dating resume is very short. And I was very insecure about finding the right person. And I was like, well, I'm good at making money, so I'll just focus all of my energy on that. And then I met my wife and I was like, family is the most important thing. I was raised thinking that. That changed pretty quickly for me. And it'll probably change for you, right? They say kids change everything, which I think is absolutely true. And I would just say that the price you charge, and I mean, Hormozy covers this in his book. Just saying his last name felt super weird. Usually it's Alex Hormozy. He's like one of those two name
yeah,
people.
He always drops them both. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Alex Hormozy says as much in his book, right? It's less about, he doesn't say it quite this way, but it's less about what you think you're worth and more about what you are worth to your potential customers, right? And so Terry Rice, he writes for Entrepreneur. He's a very smart guy. He spoke at Craft and Commerce in June, and he basically says the same thing. You know, he talks about what's a product that you have right now where you can 5x the price just by moving it up market or targeting a different type of business, right? I have a done for you podcast service where I charge $3,500 for side hustle and solopreneur folks, but for agencies I charge $10,000 because there's going to be more people involved, more stakeholders. I'm going to have to train their team. For marketing agencies who might take what I teach them and then sell it to their clients, I charge $25,000 because now I am teaching them a skill that they'll turn around and sell for probably more than that. Mm-hmm. So it's all about what your skill set is worth to your customers and less what, because I mean, it's not, you know, it's the burden of knowledge a little bit, right? Something that is easy to you or obvious to you is not easy or obvious to somebody else. This is why lawyers don't charge hundreds, thousands of dollars per hour because they're literally putting in that number of hours. It's because in that amount of time, or because they're putting in tons of work in those hours, it's because they know how to find the information as quickly and thoroughly as possible. Mm-hmm. Right? They are charging for the knowledge that they've built over their career and their schooling.
That's such a great way to put it, the burden of knowledge. I often find myself on this show talking about how challenging it is for us as experts to break down things into very small chunks that are kind of bite-sized, able to be understood by the listeners using mm-hmm. definitions. You know, a lot of people will use all of the definitions and acronyms and words. You know, we talked about it with the concept of solopreneur that people who are adults into a business career may not even know the term because we find ourselves in this sort of like ecosystem of language, I suppose, that people don't know about. So like oftentimes I'm reminding people, and maybe it's easier because I'm not the expert, which is the whole genesis of this show, go interview experts, distill the information for people who want to learn those things. Like my students that I first started working with to create this was, they were asking me questions about like how to build a blog with SEO, how to start a YouTube channel, how to start a podcast, how to write for Medium and make money, or like the list goes on, even offline things like, can you actually succeed as a hip hop artist, a dancer, a painter? You know, this is pre NFTs and more independent ways to monetize artwork. It was like, I don't know. These are way too many questions. They're all amazing. So I become like the creative generalist, helping people find clarity as opposed to being super niched down. And I'm very grateful and blessed. And it's been amazing to be able to interview people like this, you know, and take those questions that my students have and then get the information this way. I follow up with saying the tough thing has been for sure being able to remind experts like, you know, Black Adidanza, who's built a shoe brand, a dance company, all these different things. I'm asking him questions and he's like, it's hard to even say like, well, how do you achieve things in those industries because he's such a big expert in it, right?
Right?
And I think because you teach, it'll probably be a little bit easier. A lot of people don't teach at all, right? So
I will say, like, I just want to add this point because you said it, right? I used to teach college freshmen, and the crystallizing moment for summing up everything you just said there was I was teaching people, my students, how to build a blog on WordPress.com. And I was explaining the difference between posts and pages. And this was like so well rehearsed. I'd been in the WordPress space since 2005 or 2004. And this was like 2012. And one of my students raised her hands and just said, I have no idea what you just said there. And that was so crystallizing to me. Like, oh my God, this thing that I've been explaining to clients for most of my career is super confusing. And that really helped me take a step back and say, oh, I have been an expert in this for far too long. I don't even know how beginners think anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's been a fascinating byproduct of my doing this show and why I call this an infinite game is like, it's forcing me to stay in that because I hear from the audience, like, what the hell are you guys even talking about?
Yeah.
And then I'll do it. It is a little bit awkward. And this is a tip that I can give interviewers, like, because I have to ask, right? And I said that on the last episode. I was like, at the risk of, you know, sounding rhetorical and asking silly questions, like, I need to ask you to tell me what this definition is, because I do know that a lot of people are listening right now while they're walking, they're on the bus, and they're like, I have no idea what the hell they're talking about now.
I think this is a move from Josh Barrow. I love Josh Barrow. Like, I try to listen to left and right of center political commentary, and Josh Barrow is probably a little left of center. But I just love his interview style. And when he has an expert that jargons like all over the place, he'll just take a step back and he'll ask, but really define it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the guest will be like, oh, and you really want to get good ROI on this by doing blah, blah, blah with KPIs. And Josh will be like, so ROI means return on investment, and then KPI is key performance indicator, right? And so now you're not forcing the guest to define, you're clarifying and making sure that you understand it while making the guest still kind of look like an expert. I really like that move. I totally stole it from him.
I do love it. Yeah. I'm going to steal that. I'm also going to wonder and reflect when I have some time to think about if I have done that or missed chances to. And the flip of that, like the example would exist in this very episode. And at the risk of getting stuck in a roundabout here, I'll bring up the fact that I asked you to define lifestyle business. Interestingly enough, I wanted to know your definition. And so there are possible nuance, then it's kind of important to pick and choose those times. I think with KPIs,
ambiguity.
We just need the definition.
Acronyms. Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right.
You mentioned being a family person as part of your defining and crafting the lifestyle business. You also mentioned your dad and how you could potentially tell that story later on if the timing was right. I feel like being a creator who educates, a lot of time we get so focused on the business and the skill set stuff, which I know we're about to get into soon because I'm really excited to talk through podcasting and automation. Before I do, I'd hate to not find the right time to double back to that conversation about family and dad. So if you don't mind sharing what you can, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, not at all. It's interesting. The curse of being a parent, I think, is that your kids will realize how much more you knew as adults, if that makes sense. Like you're always saying, like, I'm doing this because I think it's best for you, and this is, you know, this will help you in the long run. And it's not till you're a parent that you realize that you might have squandered some of those moments. But something that I've really taken from both of my parents, but my dad mostly, his parenting style is, my dad would blow his top a lot, like, you know, New Yorker, Italian, were very emotional, and so he'd get really mad a lot. But he would always come and explain things to me after he calmed down. So, like, that's like one thing I took from my dad's parenting style that I didn't think I would take. I was like, I'm gonna be more patient. I'm like a clone of my dad. One thing I knew though that I would take from my dad was, He worked a corporate job that, I mean, he's been retired for years now. He hated it. Like, he worked for Verizon, and before Verizon was Verizon, it was like 14 other different names. He worked for all of them. He was there for years, but he would leave our house at 5 a.m. so that he could leave work at 3 p.m. so he could be home for our soccer games, our baseball games, our school play. Like, he never missed. He never missed. And that doesn't go unnoticed. And so growing up, I knew I could count on my dad being there. And when my kids were born, I knew that that was something I wanted. And so like the day I quit my job, I worked at a web development agency, and we were struggling to make money, right? It was very slow, and we had big clients. And so we were being forced to work through the weekend and forced to work late nights. And when our project manager said to us, if you guys want to get paid on time, you have to work this weekend. I said two things. That's not the social contract that we have. If I wanted to get paid based on completion of work, I would work for myself. And then I said, if this is the way it's going to be, I'm quitting, because I'm not going to miss my daughter's first steps because I had to work late for you. Mm-hmm. And a month later, I gave them a month's notice because I was a pretty high-ranking developer there. I left, and I've never looked back. I'm pretty sure I'm completely unemployable at this point. Like, I just have to work for myself.
Well, that's an interesting topic as well, because yeah. That's I think more and more people can share that story. I somehow toe the line, but I'm darn close, and I'm sure any boss I've ever had would say that.
Yeah, that it was always very like, I'm very candid. I will never not speak my mind. And I could tell some managers just hated that because they felt like I was questioning their authority. But I want answers, right? If I'm staking my well-being on your leadership, I need to know. But for sure, whenever I left, my coworkers would be like, who's going to ask the hard questions now? I'm like, you will. Notice how I didn't get fired for asking any of those questions. Mm-hmm. You can do it too.
Well, it's awesome you made that move. And I mean, I'm happy for you, but I'm more happy for your kids too, because that's what is really important to me, is close to my heart, because I've done, you know, worked in daycare, worked in foster care, worked as an educator. And I know how much of an impact that can have. I'm not judgmental of parents like your dad, like my parents who are very busy in these moments, because they don't really know different at that time, you know, mm-hmm. And it's what they could do. But that's really amazing that your dad was able to still kind of make that commitment. And my dad was too. That's really cool.
Yeah. If I feel like he knew what was impossible to know, this would be a tweet, you know, 30 years later or whatever. But I saw a tweet that was like, the only person that's going to remember you worked late is your kid, right? Or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, the only person who will remember this situation is your kid not being there, or you not being there for your kid. Mm-hmm. And
it's
that,
powerful.
Yeah, really impacted me. Even though I live my life that way, it really impacted me still, because I'm like, I feel like I can do a little bit more, and there are times where maybe I work later than I'd like, but you know, I want to make sure that I can drop everything and do whatever my kids need me to do in certain moments.
Yeah, we're definitely aligned on that one. When it comes to the ability to do that, productivity, tech stack, like, what, how do you approach that? You know, I know I heard like recently that the CEO of Patagonia has always, since the company became successful for like 20 years or something, he's taken 6 months off a year, where his interim CEOs aren't allowed to contact him. Like, super wild version of that. Like, but for you, like, kind of the behind the scenes, what does it look like to stay productive, to stay organized as a content creator? Maybe this will even go on my newsletter. How do we do it when that is the goal?
Yeah, there's a couple. You need the right systems in place, and you need to manage the expectations, right? So, like, my clients, I am very selective, even in times when I feel like I shouldn't be, right? Like, I turned down a $10,000 contract recently because I didn't like the terms of the deal and I could just tell that this would be a giant pain in the neck. And I really could have used that $10,000, you know? Like, it's been a slow year so far, and things are picking up, but I'm very selective about that. So if I think a client's going to be really demanding and expect me to be around on nights and weekends, then I just straight up tell them. I'm like, if you want this, you need an agency with multiple people, right? You need, I'm not the right fit for you because I am I am cheaper than an agency because I'm a solopreneur. And that means that we talk during business hours, unless everything's on fire. And now that I'm doing podcast coaching, that's another thing, right? Now I've picked a niche that is not necessarily mission critical in the I have to always be on call sense, right? When I was doing web development, like, yeah, there were some sites, like if a website went down, I needed to be on call because they were losing money for every minute their website was down. And again, when my kid was born, like, I'm like, I can't be my daughter, my oldest, Teresa is her name. I was like, I can't be in a position like this where I'm constantly checking my phone or worrying it's going to ring. So now I help people launch podcasts and I empower them, right? And I'm very selective about the type of work I do. And if you need a podcast producer who can turn around, you know, I listen to a bunch of legal podcasts. They're all putting out emergency podcasts around, you know, the current event. I've already timestamped this enough. I won't timestamp it again. You know, around this current event that's happening. That's not the type of people I cater to, or I help them launch and then allow them to hand it off to their team. So that's one thing. I'm very selective about the type of work and the type of projects I take on. The other thing, and this is my toxic trait, I try to automate everything, like probably too much. Like, oh, I did it once, I should automate it. And that's just like not, you know, for those listening who might be unfamiliar with automation in general, right? For me, it is getting robots or computer programs to do things that I would normally have to do. And so the example I give for people who aren't familiar with automation is one, automatic bill pay, right? Every month your bills, your tuition is paid, or your water bill is paid, or your rent is paid, or whatever. That's automation, right? A date hits, money comes out of your account. The other thing, right, is you sign up for a newsletter or something. You sign up for, let's say you're shopping on a website and it's like, get 10% off, join our mailing list. You join the mailing list and you get an email immediately. That's an automation. There's not a person saying, oh, Jimmy just signed up for our mailing list, let me send him an email. Mm-hmm. So it's getting robots to do things that you or another human don't personally have to do. And so whenever I do something a couple of times, I think, how can I automate this? It's usually connecting two programs, right? So like I use Thrivecart to sell my membership. And when someone becomes a member, I have them added to a mailing list in ConvertKit. And so one of the automations I have set up is somebody makes a purchase in Thrivecart, they get tagged in ConvertKit as a member. And now they get their members only newsletter. So I think if this is something I'm going to keep having to do, I'm going to automate it so that if I'm out at a Yankee game or at the beach or up in a lake house with my family and someone buys something from me, I don't need to respond to them immediately because the robots are taking care of it.
Mm-hmm. The upside to AI taking over our world.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I mean, and the no-code movement has been something that's been happening for a long time where you used to need to know how to write programs to have apps. No-code is these apps like Zapier is one. Make.com is another, where Bubble is, I think, one of the most popular no-code tools out there, where you can have programming logic. If this thing happens, then this thing should happen, right? Is your basic program logic, without having to know programming. Mm-hmm. And so that helps people who never want to learn code. But for people like me who have studied code his whole life and has been a coder his whole life up until a year and a half ago when I decided to just do podcasting full time, it helps me too, because I already think like that and I don't have to set up a development environment anymore. But when I need to write little snippets of code to help those automations, I can.
Yeah, which is really cool because then you can customize things. You mentioned that you help people start podcasts and that now that you podcast full time. So we need to make sure that we don't run out of time in this episode talking about this conversation, because I do know that it could be a 40-hour plus episode, because I've been spending about 40 hours writing a book on how to start a podcast. I have that table of contents in my head. So it doesn't take a lot for me to think of kind of those overall keywords that people may need to know. When you think of the biggest mistakes people make in getting started, what are some things that come to mind?
I think the biggest mistake, non-technically, right? I think the biggest mistake is not defining your mission statement, right? And so, I mean, people will word this a different separate ways, but for me, the mission statement is, who do you help and how do you help them? 78% of people listen to podcasts to learn something new. They have a problem that they need solved, or they need a mindset, right? That where they need that weekly affirmation, right? And so when I am working with people who are pre-launch or post-launch, really, right? You can change. The beauty of podcasting is that it's not a stone building, right? Mm-hmm. It's very malleable. Define your mission statement like this. My podcast helps group of people solve specific problem by, and then the goal of each episode. So for my podcast workflows, my podcast helps busy solopreneurs who have a podcast spend less time on their podcast by teaching them workflow and process improvements in every episode.
And I had actually jotted down that phrase that you use to bring up and say, like, okay, this is why this could be a 40-hour or 140-hour or 400-hour episode, because it's exactly what you do, and you could do it for episodes infinitely.
Yeah.
What are some other of your favorite things to teach people when it comes to this medium?
Great question. I love teaching the automation stuff because it feels like magic. And when someone gets it to click, the look on their face is priceless. So one of the first things I automate usually with my clients is booking guests, right? We set up Calendly, we connect it to whatever their system is. So that could be Trello or Airtable or Notion. And this is another really important thing too, right? Some people say, like, oh, I track all my episodes in a notebook or on a piece of paper or whatever. No, track it in on some sort of Kanban board, right? Where you have different statuses and you know the status of each episode. This is important, right? Because now you're not flying by the seat of your pants, right? In the pre-show, we talked about how you have six episodes kind of waiting in the wings. If you don't have a tracker, then you're just kind of going, oh, which one am I going to publish? Oh, I need to edit this one now. Oh my gosh, it's Friday and the show comes out Monday and you know, we're taking a weekend trip. When am I going to figure out when to do this? Where when you have your tracker, right, when someone signs up for my Calendly link, they go into Airtable and then I'm looking at their status. I know when we record. I know right after we record, I'm going to put it in Dropbox. And that helps you get ahead. So like doing those things is one of my favorite things to teach, because the concept might seem hard, but when I work with a podcaster to put that system in place, it improves their quality of life, because now they're not freaking out about, well, what episode am I going to publish? Oh, according to my tracker, I've got 4 episodes ready to go. They are all scheduled. And so now I just need to think about, oh, what am I going to publish in October or whatever?
Mm-hmm. For me, I'm a bit old school still, maybe using a spreadsheet, but
yeah,
it works. Well, I mean, whatever, for now.
Right? Yeah.
And what's interesting to me too, and I don't want to talk about mine much. I can share this with my own, you know, audience, stuff like that. But for me, Calendly was interesting because I've had it on sometimes and I've had it off sometimes, depending on where I am in life. But I'm super excited to be more full-time with the show and use it. Mm-hmm. The reason why it was turned off a number of times is, like, I guess what people would consider big gets. Like, to me, I don't really think that way. I just love creating with everyone. Yeah. However, someone like Brendan Kane is like, can't do any of the times that I have in my Calendly. Right. I'm like, well, I don't care. Just let me know. And so that was starting to happen because I have guests with much larger audiences now who definitely don't fit into the times that I would set. And then it kind of became an interesting challenge of practice that I share sometimes. It's something that I would love to get back to being able to do when my lifestyle supports it a bit more. And so when you mentioned the idea of, oh, I have to edit this one, this is an interesting topic because I know at least 4 recent guests who have tried hiring someone to help with editing. I don't think I've heard anyone using AI per se to edit, but that's a really big topic. It's obviously a gap in the marketplace in terms of clarity for podcasters. What about that aspect of going from you and I just finished this, and then how do we get it so we can move it in that Trello board to ready to upload?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, I would say, like, definitely, unless you are an editor yourself, an editor is the place where you can save the most time, right? I have an editor who edits each of my episodes for like around $50, right? Because it's pretty light. The work he's doing is pretty light. He's going to combine, he's going to clean up. I'll make edit notes during the recording. So I'll say, like, edit here, blah, blah, blah. If I tell him to do advanced editing, that's going to be like $100. But either way, those things would take me at least an hour, and I charge $250 an hour, right? So opportunity cost versus billable hours, I am losing money when I edit. Some people can't tie their hourly rate like that to specific tasks, but I would think of the opportunity cost. If you are editing on a Saturday during family dinner instead of sitting with your family, is that worth $50 to you? It's absolutely worth $50 to me. So I would consider that. But this is also one of the reasons I work with solopreneurs, right? Because we do want to tie the podcast to return on investment. That said, what I do is I use Riverside. And so this is going to get slightly complicated. The things that you should pull out are download, put them in Dropbox, email editor, have the editor re-upload to Dropbox, publish when you're ready, right? Those are the tent poles of this. Now let's get slightly into the weeds. I download the files myself from Riverside. Riverside does have a Dropbox automation, but me not automating that part is kind of a reminder that I need to write the summary, because the summary and the top takeaways are the last thing I do before I never see the episode again, right? So, I mean, I'll see it in my feed. I'm subscribed to my own podcasts, but I don't see it again after that. So I download the files. I use an app called Hazel. It is a file automation app. And I am watching the downloads folder for these files from Riverside. I always make sure to have the episode number in the file name. This is the linchpin of my entire automation process. So Hazel will look for files from Riverside with the episode number in it, grab those, put them all in a folder with the episode number. It'll label the host and the guest audio. I write up the top takeaways in my edit notes, and I move that folder into the needs editing folder in Dropbox. When I do that, Airtable automatically updates the status to that episode based on the episode number, right? So today I recorded episode 330. There is an episode 330 in Airtable. That got marked when the guest filled out the form to get into Airtable. I use make.com for all of my automations, right? But I have an automation that looks at the folder number, matches it with the episode number in Airtable, updates the status to out for edit. Then my editor gets an email saying, hey, new episode ready for edit. And that's all because the instructions are in that folder too. The edit instructions are in that folder. When my editor uploads the episode back to Dropbox, he puts it in the production folder. There are two versions of it. One is ad-free for my members. One is ad-supported for non-members. I tell him to keep the episode number in the file name, right? So when it's added to production, make.com will tell Airtable, hey, episode 330 is back. Mark it ready for publish. When it's marked ready for publish, my VA gets an email and she handles the rest. There's a Google Doc in Airtable that she clicks on to grab my notes, puts them in WordPress and in Transistor. And that's the whole process, right? It sounds super convoluted. The things you need to remember are, I download the files, I put them in Dropbox, my editor gets an email, and then he uploads it back to Dropbox. If you don't have a VA, do it yourself. If you do have a VA, let your VA know, your virtual assistant or whoever. If you have somebody who publishes your podcast episodes for you, most people end up publishing their episodes themselves.
You use the term convoluted. I mean, I think, like you said, it gets into the weeds a bit and it's a bit detailed, but it's amazing because without doing that, it's a little bit too much of an overview that people are like, yeah, wait, but what do you mean? And especially if they go to start trying to execute on that and there's like a step missing. So I really appreciate you going that deep with it. I was just smiling because it sounds like an absolute dream. I have my process. I might have even used the term automated previously, but it's not, having heard that. But there's a workflow, I guess. And
yeah.
Now I have a goalpost to work towards.
Yeah. And I'll say, like, I've been podcasting for over 10 years. Like, my process didn't start out that way.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even get a VA till the pandemic, right? When I was, because my wife's a nurse. She was still going to work. I had children at home. I was only working half of the week, right? Because, again, she works 3 12-hour shifts, right? So on the days that she wasn't working, I was working. And then Sundays were for family, right? So I was working max 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I needed a VA to keep the wheels on the truck or the wheels on the plane, the wings on the plane, whatever that saying is. But it all starts here, right? If you have a podcast or you're thinking about a podcast, you're like, well, that sounds like a lot. It all starts here. The first question I ask my coaching clients on day one, tell me everything you do for an episode. If they don't have it written down and they're just doing it from memory, the first thing we do is write it down. And I'm like, here is your checklist. Then we work off that checklist to see what two-step processes we can automate. Booking a guest. Okay, great. Two steps, one automation. Once the guest is booked, move them to Trello. Great. That's two steps, one automation, right? So everything I did, it's two-step automations, and I just chain them together over time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're thinking that sounds super complicated and there's no way I could ever do it, your first step is just make a checklist. Put it in a note, write it down in a notebook, whatever you're most comfortable with, just so you know everything you have to do for every episode. And there's your first, it's called an SOP or a standard operating procedure. There's your first one. And now you're well on your way to making your life a lot easier.
I don't want to get off topic, but it reminds me of the book, The E-Myth, where, the idea of building operating procedures and manuals and this idea of automating things for, in that case, obviously other humans to take on. And in this case, sometimes we can use robots. Mm-hmm. The idea of automating guests, this is an interesting one too. I feel that makes sense from the Calendly with outreach? Is that one of the things that just needs to forever be a human activity?
That's a great question. Mostly yes, but finding the guest is a manual process. Reaching out to them doesn't have to be, right? And so I'll describe two other processes I have here. One is my show's been around for a long time. It's in the top 1% of all podcasts. Not to brag or anything, but...
Mic drop.
Yeah, right. Top 1%, I'll say top 18% means you're publishing one episode every 90 days. That's all. Top 18%, you publish one episode per month or per 3 months. So like shoot for that, right? That's great. Anyway, my show has been around for a long time. It has built a following. And so a lot of people reach out to me to come on my show. And it's always like the same. Hi, my client is blah, blah. These are all the reasons blah, blah is great. Would you like to talk to blah, blah? I'm like, no, but here is an application form. Go to howibuilt.it/apply, fill out the form. They'll get added to Airtable. And then when I am evaluating guests, I will evaluate them there, right? If I accept them, they get sent a Calendly link. This is too complicated. This was extra on my part. I'm not going to describe this process because it barely applies to anybody. But suffice to say, when they're accepted, they get a Calendly link and their Airtable record is moved to my production schedule. Usually they're rejected and they get an email saying like, hey, here are some of the reasons why I reject people. And it's like, usually your pitch was too self-promoting and didn't tell me how it could help my audience. That's for people who are coming to me. For people I'm going out to, I usually keep a note of people I come across the internet that I think will be interesting guests. I do have relationships with several podcast bookers who understand my show and my goals. And so I'll just let them know, like, hey, I'm booking guests if you have anybody who think they're good. But for finding guests, it's one of two ways. If I'm like sitting on a Friday and I'm like, all right, I got to plan the next 20 episodes. I need a bunch of guests. Then I'll go to that file. I'll find email addresses. And I do have an Airtable base where I fill out a few things, right? Their name, their email address, the topic I want to talk to them about. This is really important. It drives me crazy when someone's like, hey, do you want to come on my podcast? Also, give me 5 questions that I can ask you. That's not my job, right? My job stops at, yes, I'll come on your podcast. Your job is what is best for your audience, right? So like, your email, Justin, was great. Like, this is my audience. This is also my audience. These are some of the things that we're going to cover. I felt pretty prepared for this show, right? So I always say, I'd love to talk to you about this thing, unless there's something else you'd rather talk about. Then I have another field called personal note. And this is usually 1 or 2 sentences about why I'm reaching out to them and why I like them. The reason I have that is because most outreach emails are going to read the same. Hi, I'm Joe. I host a podcast. The podcast is for these people. Would you like to come on my podcast? Right? That doesn't need to be repeated. But the personal note, hey, I really appreciate what you said on Twitter the other day about blah, 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 blah. Now that's personal. Now that's not just mass outreach. So I'll fill out like 20 of those. It'll take me about an hour. And then I mark them all send. And Airtable sends out 20 emails without me having to open my email app. And if they come back and say yes, great, they already have the scheduling link. If they come back and say no, I mark them as maybe later, right? Or definitely, like if they're like, I'm never going to come on your show, I'm like, all right, well, fine. I'll mark you as no. Usually it's, now's not a good time. I'll mark them as maybe later.
Oprah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, Oprah's like, I don't need you. So that's usually the case. However, if I'm having a conversation with people on, say, Twitter, and I'm sliding into their DMs, and I'll just be like, hey, let's get you on the show. I have a secret link that I send to people I invite that doesn't ask as many questions. Because, why do you want to be on the show? You told me to come on your show, right? But the other thing I do is I fill out as much of the form for them as possible. so that it makes it super easy for them. And I just, I'm like, here's what I had in mind. Feel free to change anything. Once you click submit, it'll take you to my Calendly where you can pick a time that works best for you. If none of those times work, let me know. I'm happy to work on your schedule. And that's another thing, right? Because if I'm asking them to come on my show and they're taking time out of their day, then I want to be as flexible as possible. There are people yeah. who've invited me onto their show and they're like, oh, I only record at these times. And
I'm like, well, Friday at 11.
Yeah. I'm like, I can't do that. And they're like, well, what about, you know, well, that's the only time I record. I'm like, well, okay, I guess we're not recording then.
Yeah. And that's what I was kind of referencing earlier about Calendly, because like in your case, full transparency, you're a little more in the driver's seat than I am, where I am in my progression as a podcaster. Nothing wrong with that for me.
Like, yeah.
I'm humble enough to admit that. I do get pretty, I guess, like I said, what people would consider big guests. And I love how Tim Ferriss says that when people ask him about his early success, he's like, well, one of the things I did was go through, similar to what you said about a checklist, but in his case, it was removing friction for guests.
Yeah.
And I've been guests on quite a few shows now too. And sometimes I get like this 20-minute survey and I'm like, what the hell? As I just, you know, like, like I can't imagine as an interviewer asking people kind of like in that style, you know, it seems kind of wild. So I'm often trying to, again, remove friction. A lot of times because of the guests too, they do have EAs, they have assistants. So I'm getting contacted by their assistants. They can't then go ask the actual person a question to come back. Oh, hey, I need to come back, double back to Justin. Like they don't really care too much in their day to day. So those types of things of removing friction for guests, because I do an interview style show, is something that I think is pretty important to me.
Yeah. I, you know, it's about finding the right balance, I think. Because I want to get as much information up front as possible so that I know, I want to make sure my research is right. I want to make sure I'm on the right path. I want to make sure I'm using a profile picture that, or like a picture for the art that they like, right? Instead of like the one I found on LinkedIn from 10 years ago. That said, none of those fields are required. And I do try to fill in as much as possible to reduce that friction, right? Mm-hmm. At some point, we're going to hash out a time anyway. And because I am self-employed and podcasting is what I do most of the time, I have a lot of open. I used to do the Pat Flynn thing of like, I only record on Thursdays, right? But then I started, well, the pandemic happened and I couldn't just do that. And I started, you know, I started making more exceptions. And now I'm like, you know what? I'll have blocks across the week at different times to accommodate different time zones. But, you know, I find that like using a like Calendly as a scheduling link, for example, that just reduces the dance, right? So it sounds like you're in Canada. I think I must know that. You said you drove down to New York. So I'm going to guess that we're on the same time zone, right? Are you in East Coast?
Yep.
So it's pretty easy for us to find a time because we're in the right time zone, right? I just interviewed somebody who was in Finland and he didn't tell me until he was in Finland, right? He's an American living in Finland.
Right.
That we recorded, it was 8 p.m. his time, right? Now, maybe he's still working on American hours, right? But if somebody is like, hey, can we find something like within some reasonable business hour for me? I'll work with them on that, right? But, you know, usually my schedule's open enough that people can find a time that works for them.
Yeah, for sure, which is awesome. When it comes to like kind of scaling engagement, those keywords, you know, taking, we create this episode. And then I think the obvious thing is, hey, you could cut it up and put it into social clips and you could write a Twitter thread about it, whether it's automation or otherwise. How do you help coach people to take these episodes and then actually grow their audience?
Yeah, this is one of the hardest things, right? And this is like, this has been a question that has come up for me a lot recently. Like, how do I automate the publicizing of the podcast? And unfortunately, this still requires a lot of human intervention, right? I mean, I'm using tools like CapShow and Cast Magic to find good timestamps. I'll scour transcripts. But for me, and what I recommend my students and clients do is try to take notes during the episode, right? If someone says something super interesting, mark down the timestamp and a couple of keywords, right? Because automated transcripts are a relatively new thing and a super powerful tool, even if it's not fully accurate, right? If I know that, like, again, my guest who I recorded with today mentioned, like, we talked about storytelling, and I'm like, how do you tie up a good story? And he said, a mentor of mine said, tying up a good story, a documentary, fiction, whatever, is like running through a house and slamming all the doors, right? You've opened a bunch of doors and now you want to close them. And I'm like, this is a great cold open. So I wrote down the time he said that, approximate time. And now I'll know to look at my transcript later and find the exact phrasing and clip that out, right? Or I'll tell my editor, hey, it's around this spot. He says these things. Make that the cold open for the episode. So it's really about that. CapShO and Cast Magic and other tools like this will go through your episode and pull out what it thinks are interesting. I think that CapShO is a little better than Cast Magic at this point. And then it'll also give you timestamped clips. And so you can try using those, right? And maybe you'll find a couple of good ones. They pick 10, you probably get one good one out of it. But that's really more for you and the way, what is the thing that will resonate most for your audience? AI can't know that. AI will never know that. Right. Yeah. Generalized AI will never know that. Maybe you have a super highly personalized AI like Jarvis from Iron Man. maybe it can know that and Paul Bettany can be the voice, but AI today can't know that. And so that's really mostly up to you. So that falls into the realm of either you do it yourself or maybe this is something an assistant can do for you. Posting it can be one of the social media tools like Typefully or Hype Fury or Hootsuite. Or again, it could be your VA. I manage all my social media posts in Airtable. My VA has access. She knows when to post and publish and things like that.
Cool. A quick side note. Do you pay for transcription still? Because that's been an interesting arc too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I do in all accounts. So I will publish the automatically generated one because I'll usually have that first. But for how I built it, I still pay my transcriber, Evelyn. She's great. She's great because she knows the jargon and the terminology that's used. She adds relevant links to the transcript, and she labels everything properly.
That's awesome.
I don't have to review her work. With an AI generated transcript, I still have to review that work, right?
Mm-hmm.
AI transcript is better than nothing. Full stop. I think you need a transcript if you're going to have a podcast, and if you can't afford a transcriber, then AI generated is the way to go. For my solo show, I have my VA. She does a very good job of transcribing. And I learned this because when creating SOPs, I would record myself doing something and then tell her to transcribe it and write out the steps. And I saw, oh, these transcripts are good. So I have her transcribe my solo show.
Interesting. I know you already dropped the mic when we talked about your podcast being in the top 1%, but we'll have to drop it again soon because naturally we always run out of time and there's a moment to close all those doors.
Yes.
And I just really, like I said, off the top, appreciate you taking the time. You did say something though that I think is really important that people walking down the street with their earbuds in might be like, oh, they never doubled back to that. And it was the fact that you said, eventually we are going to have to get to the point where you can reinvest in your show because you're making money doing it. And that's why you work with solopreneurs. That, to say, is a huge struggle for people would be a even huger understatement. So again, I recognize 400-hour podcast episode if we want it to be, but your wisdom, what you've learned over the years helping podcasters monetize, what are some things that come to mind as well?
Yeah, great question. I have a framework for this, right? I call it the SMASH framework. So I'll give quick one sentence overview of each, right? The first S, sponsorship. This is the most common one, right? A brand pays you to mention them on your podcast. Rating of one to five difficulty, where one is easy and five is difficult. I'm going to put this one at like a four. I know I just did the five hand motion. I'm going to put this at like a four because you need relationships or a big following. You need one of those, relationships or a big following, to get sponsors. M, memberships. This is when people pay you something per month or per year to get exclusive content. Ad-free, extended episodes, an extra newsletter, the raw unedited or a live stream with interview, some bonus content. I'm going to put this at a five because to make real money, you need a lot of members, and you which means you need even more listeners to get people to duke you their money on a monthly basis. A is affiliate. Getting started with this, I'm going to put it at a one. You can get started right now. Making real money, it's probably closer to a three, depending on the affiliate programs. But this is when you promote a product and then you get a commission based on all the sales. Amazon affiliates are the easiest to get started with because everybody buys from Amazon. They pay garbage. Actually, they pay very generously because Amazon doesn't need affiliates. So the fact that they pay out anything is amazing. Programs like ConvertKit or website hosting companies, those pay out pretty well on a recurring basis. So find a tool that resonates with your audience and talk about it regularly on your show. Make it clear it's an affiliate link. So that's the A. The second S is selling. You are selling a product or service. So this is going to be an authority building podcast where you're probably not going to have sponsors, but you will directly sell to your audience. I always use a bicycle shop for some reason. Like, that makes perfect sense. But let's say you have a bicycle shop, right? You're going to start a podcast called, you know, Joe's Bicycle Podcast or whatever, right? I don't know much about bikes. and instead of having a spot like an e-bike sponsor or a tire pump sponsor or a helmet sponsor or whatever, you're going to talk about your products. Hey, if you sign up for our online course, we'll teach you how to fix your bike yourself. Or do you need a bike? We ship to the continental US. So check out our website, find the perfect bike for you. Those sort of things. That's S, the second S. The last letter is H, and that's helping. This is similar to selling, but it's a little bit different because you're helping people through coaching, consulting, and courses. This is great for solo episodes where you're building your own authority, right? So if you are a podcast coach, you have a podcast about how people can save time, make money, and grow their podcast. Now you are showing people you know exactly what you're talking about. And then at the beginning and end of your show, you get them on your mailing list. And that's where you can form a deeper relationship and sell them on your coaching or consulting services. I didn't give difficulties to the last two, but I'm going to say selling and helping are both around a three. If your mission statement is aligned, right, and you're providing real value, you can get clients that way or customers that way.
When you talked about sponsorships, you said the term big following. And I know that that's something that people who Google how to make money on my podcast, they're going to get so many differences. What is your at least thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't think you need. I mean, this is deeply personal for me, but I've launched four podcasts. But the three I did on my own, I launched with sponsors. So I had no downloads and still had sponsors for those episodes because I had strong relationships within my niche. Because the people who sponsored my show knew me, they knew I already had a following, and they knew it was worthwhile to support that endeavor. So again, as long as I tell people this, right? I want millions of downloads. If your addressable audience is 1,000 people, you will never have millions of downloads. Right. But if you have 800 listeners, that is 80% of your addressable audience. And so you come to a sponsor and you say, hey, I'm not getting millions of downloads, but my audience is ready with their wallets open for my recommendations.
Right.
If you sponsor my show, you're going to reach a highly targeted niche that trusts me. And so I don't think you need a lot of downloads for sponsorships. I think if you have relationships within your niche, go to those people first because they already trust what you're doing and they're willing to support the show short term. And you know what? It doesn't take it. Starting a podcast is more expensive than starting a blog, but it's still just a few hundred bucks in a year. So you get, you know, start there. Hey, I just want to break even on this podcast.
I feel like you're sharing that. Is massive just in itself as a statement, because a lot of people wouldn't have even thought that way for sure. You mentioned the idea of this is great for solo episodes. And that brings up kind of one final question that I have. And that's the idea of solo episodes in general. It was actually, David Meltzer for about a year who was telling me you should be making solo episodes. And then finally, when I actually started making them was when John Lee Dumas said that. I don't know why, maybe because he's so specific to the podcast world, but when he told me that, I was like, all right, fine, you'll see one tomorrow. But his advice, similar to he gave Chris Gebo, and was the idea of like pumping them out, and similar to his show too, where it's like there's so many of them, basically a daily solo show, and then you do interview people on top of that. For me and my audience, that was too much, I think. I'm just curious, my show aside, how you tackle that. Do people create two different shows? Do they create on the same one? Just what is your thought?
Yeah, great question. I think it depends on the mission, right? So podcast workflows, I knew that was totally different from how I built it. Those are my two shows, right? How I Built It is my much bigger interview show that's been around for years. And podcast workflows is relatively new, right? I knew that needed to be a separate show because it was just so different from How I Built It. For How I Built It, though, I have usually 3 or 4 interviews for every solo episode. And so usually it's more of a personal update or it's stuff I'm working on, very build in public sort of stuff, but still specific tips on, right, how to automate, what to think about. And those do, like, some of them do pretty well, right? If they're more prepared, they do very well, right? If it's just like, oh, shoot, I need an episode right now, they don't do as well. And that's going to be true of any content you create. Now, the other thing I do is every Friday, I have what's called a How I Built Bits episode. And that is 10 minutes or less about a specific tool, process, or tip, right? And it's usually... I'm repurposing blog posts for that, and I'm repurposing newsletter segments for that. So the most recent one is called, like, What Baby Clothes Can Teach You About Knowing Your Customers.
Awesome.
And it's basically about how, like, I found these pajamas that were reverse zipper. So the zipper starts at the foot and goes up. And I'm sorry, starts at the neck and goes down. Sorry. I just described a regular zipper that first time. And I thought, like,
so they can't take them off.
Yeah, exactly. So they can't take them off. And it's easier to corral the legs, right? You don't have to fully take off the pajamas to change them. I'm like, surely a parent who has to wake up in the middle of the night and is half asleep dealing with a crying baby invented these.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas, like, there's like cloth looped button pajamas. And I'm like, only a sociopath would invent this. So, like, you know, it's episodes like that. They're really short. They're really consumable. They tend to do pretty well because they're not super long. And all of those types of solo episodes, again, are with the goal of me leveraging and displaying my expertise so that people hire me for podcasting or automation.
Amazing. I appreciate it. I know that every so often when there's just such great episodes, I'm like, well, we could do Twitter spaces. We could build an entire show together. Like, there's all these things where it's like at a point you have to be like, all right, naturally, like a great movie, perhaps there will be a sequel, but we need to wrap. I'd love to ask you the theme rapid fire questions because I'm so excited to tie those together like a documentary someday.
Awesome.
Before I do, I'll just say, like, on all these topics that we've run through, being a solopreneur, lifestyle business, starting a podcast, automation, monetization, you know, just being a dad, whatever it is, I'd hate to leave without you being like, oh, I was going to say this, or, you know, if there's any final thoughts on these topics.
I think I said everything I wanted to say, but I will say this. I mentioned not making your hobby into work, right? I've heard it called a jobby before.
Never heard that.
I love that term. I think Mike Hurley from Relay FM is the first person I heard say it. But something that gave me real clarity on this was the book 4,000 Hours. Really uplifting book about how you basically only have 4,000 hours in your life. And so you need to use them wisely. And he tells a story about how Rod Stewart was really into model trains. Still is. Rod Stewart's still alive. And the model trains were not, they were very amateurish. And he relayed the story that he's so bad at model trains that nobody would ever pay him to do them. And so that's how I approach my hobbies now. I love playing the drums. I'm okay. I'm a very like pop punk, like 2000s pop punk drummer. I'm not good enough for somebody to pay me to play the drums. So that will always be a hobby for me. And I would say, like, if you're going to have a lifestyle business, have hobbies that aren't related to your work. It's important to switch contexts and get away from the day-to-day, because it helps you reset. And I think that entrepreneurs, especially in the beginning, are too worried that the moment they stop, they're going to lose momentum, when actually you need to recharge your car or put gas in your car if you want to keep going that next 100 miles or 200 miles. I guess you get really bad gas mileage in this analogy.
I got you though. That's extremely wise advice. I love learning so much. Like, I like being a beginner. Mm-hmm. I like that feeling. Yeah. So for me, and also because my brain goes in a million different directions to help me not be too much of a shiny object person, I need to not only have hobbies, but ones that are new. And so I try and always have one thing at a moment that I'm learning that definitely falls into that category. So
yeah, I love that.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
In terms of the theme question, so I get, maybe it's drums, but maybe you've already learned that. I don't know. It could be completely off topic, but one thing that you are learning right now.
Wow. It feels like a cop-out, but learning how to read more fiction is what I'm going to say. Because I read almost exclusively business books. And I'm just like, at some point, like literally 2 weeks ago, we're getting ready to go to the beach. And I'm like, I'm so tired of business books. And so I'm learning to forge the habit of, when I reach for a book, it doesn't have to necessarily directly enrich my business. It could enrich me in some other way. And so I've made a promise to not read any more business books this year, and only read fiction or nonfiction business, which is usually like biographies or history.
Mm-hmm. And the arc that we take as creators is incredible. I said that to my wife just last night. Predictable.
It's awesome.
Yeah. One piece of advice. You have so much wisdom and like things that you can share or tweet or whatever. I know that this is a deeper question sometimes when we have kids, but if you were to leave one piece of advice for the next generation, what would it be?
You don't need to wake up at 5 a.m. to be successful. I'm like so tired of that, right? I guess the bigger lesson here is what works for somebody else is not guaranteed to work for you.
Right.
You need to take the advice with a grain of salt and do what works best for you. I wake up at 5 a.m. still. I used to wake up at 5 a.m. and start working by 6. I have small children, so now I wake up at 5 a.m., I shower, I get coffee, and pray that they sleep until 6, right?
Yeah.
And that's like, I'm not working for 3 hours, right? So you got to do what works best for you, and know that past success does not predict future outcomes.
You do have to do cold showers and eat liver, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, except for the guy who's like, don't shower. right? I saw a guy that was like, wake up at 5:30, don't shower, drink 8 ounces of cold water, get right to work. I'm like, don't shower. I am a greasy Italian. I need to shower or I feel disgusting.
I hear you there. Yeah. I'll use both names because you said that earlier. Alex Hormozi shared something very similar today too about like, just so you know, you don't have to do da 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 da. Try not doing it and see if your business falls apart. And if it doesn't, then you know you don't need to do it.
That's anytime anybody gets pushback on those things, they're like, well, that's just what works for me. And I'm like, that's not how you framed it.
Yeah.
When you start it with, if you want to be successful, you need to, that's not framing it as that worked for me. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like just such a stupid growth hack.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And then finally, if I pass you the mic, you are a podcaster, so this will come much more naturally than for any other people a lot of the times. But if you were to ask me a question on these topics or otherwise, what comes to mind?
So my question is, you mentioned that you teach high school age students, right?
Yes.
What do you learn from them as far as cultural zeitgeist goes? Because when I taught college freshmen, which are basically still high school students, I would constantly ask them, what apps are you using? What's cool in pop culture right now? So what do you learn from your high school age students that I'm going to assume we're close to the same age. I'm 37. Maybe you're younger than me. That we wouldn't learn.
I'm an 84.
Okay. 85. Great. So we're like the same age. Yeah. Something that that you learn from your high school students that we wouldn't learn from our contemporaries.
This may end up being in a completely different direction than anticipated, but a huge learning moment for me, and it's a big part of the show, is recognizing that I thought mistakenly that because I'm older, I'm not up on as much of like social media culture and content creation things as youth are. However, what I've come to realize is that a lot of them don't know what the heck they're doing either. And I'll share one specific story. When TikTok first rebranded and became TikTok from Musical.ly, I downloaded it and I was like, oh, this is going to be a great place to create. And I made the first few videos and they were terrible because they just didn't make any sense. There was no like consistency. It was like random stuff. I was not dancing, but it was like random edits.
Yeah.
They were like 2 years ahead of their time kind of in terms of what they started adding for functionality.
Yeah.
But like, I kind of thought they were interesting. And then, you know, I think they got like zero views, even though it was like the hot new app. But I was sitting with a student and I shared that like I wanted to start making TikToks and I was trying to think of what they would be about. And she just like lost it about how ridiculous that was, that an adult, like an older person would have TikTok, but that anyone would have TikTok. And it was such an interesting moment because I was explaining to her like, and she had aspirations of being a full-time podcaster.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you don't have to use TikTok, but why would you like disregard any platform because it's not cool when it's going to be something that could be a really good opportunity for growth? That was one of the real moments where I was like, oh, wait a second. Like, I actually know more about social media than kids who are learning who don't really know how to create yet. I feel like the other thing too, that's a little bit different than most people, is that because I work with such like youth who are really struggling socioeconomic wise and things like that a lot of the time, or just they have so much trauma in their lives, that it's wild, but they're not like, I'm not in a regular high school, right? So I'm literally in jails and hospitals and crisis units and schools for teen moms and addiction centers. They're not like wearing a certain type of clothing and then, you know, the other people don't fit in or, you know, doing these things that make it clicky where I could maybe learn some of that sort of like conventional, like what's the in thing right now.
Yeah.
Their lives are so busy that it's almost like they have a weird maturity to all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I don't learn a lot of those things that I maybe would if I was teaching at like college or a regular high school.
Yeah. Wow. That's super interesting. Cause you're right. Like, they're kind of forced to grow up faster. I think my takeaway from the TikTok story would be, that high school age students are not necessarily thinking about growing their online presence in such a way that we think about it yet, right? Like, I asked a group of high school students on career day. They had a career day. I came to talk to them, like, so what happens if TikTok gets banned? And they're like, whatever, we'll just go to Instagram. Like, they were just super nonchalant about it. Like, I don't even, who cares? Like, that's just one less app on my phone. I thought it was so funny.
I know we've gone pretty long today. I'll tack on one other quick story. Mm-hmm. I've twice had students with over 100,000 Instagram followers.
Dang.
And in both cases, they got rid of their socials because they didn't, like, it just was having a negative impact on them. And their therapist was like, yeah, like, you need to get rid of this.
Mm.
Side note, their therapist didn't understand online business either.
Right.
So that didn't help. And then in the future, a couple of them have definitely regretted, like, losing that, basically giving up that following.
Yeah.
But it started off from the place that you're talking about, natural, organic, sharing stuff. In two of the three cases, it was being a teen mom, which tends to go pretty viral.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, they were having weird stuff happening where there were so many fake accounts of them using all their photos, mm-hmm. or they would be out in public and people knew who they were.
Yeah.
They were being stalked, like things like this, where, or threats from other, you know, people that they consider ops, like,
yeah,
because they, yeah. So instead of being like, hey, maybe I could pivot this into something more sustainable, they gave it up, but they didn't recognize that they were losing an opportunity. That was really another eye-opening moment for me too.
Yeah. It sounds like the therapist, instead of telling them to delete social media, should be teaching them how to work through and learn to ignore some of that stuff. Because I'll tell you what, like, one of my tweets that went viral, I know we're like super over time. One of my tweets that went viral was like me telling, like, talking about how Philly sports fans are like the meanest people on the planet. And that went viral because like a Philly sports radio network retweeted it and said, cry about it. And then like for the next 12 hours, I was getting tweets like, you should kill yourself. And I was like, part of me was like, thanks for confirming. But then I was like, this is really weighing on me. I'm like a fully grown, well-adjusted adult. And it's like negatively, I deleted that tweet and then I like deleted Twitter from my phone for like a week. I was like, man, I'm well-adjusted. So like high school students dealing with that, like deleting it, sure, like that'll make that specific problem go away. But like, we're an online society. Like, you need to learn how to deal with that sort of stuff, mm-hmm. even if it's not on Instagram, even if it's going to be like in the metaverse or Apple's Vision Pro verse or whatever.
And I've had that on Instagram too, where I posted something and then someone, you know, struggling with mental illness, like just went rampant, like, you know, 12 comments underneath one of my posts about how I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a therapist. I shouldn't be sharing mindset advice because people need real help. They need to go to hospitals. What I'm posting is going to make people kill themselves. Like, it was pretty wild too. And then it entered my DMs. And again, similarly to what you just said, we're the same age. It did weigh on me for a few days. And I was like, well, how could a 17-year-old handle these types of things? Like, I can't even imagine. My first episode of the show was with Buster Scheer, who had millions of followers. He's basically still a teenager. But he shared that even though he blew up pretty young, it was very slow growth where he learned these things, and mm-hmm. that he's super grateful for not having a viral TikTok go crazy or something, but to progress and have good mentors and people around him. Enter this show, and its whole reason for being is that I want to be able to bring these lessons to youth who can go about being content creators in this economy in a healthy way. And I mean, we could definitely talk forever, but that's a third great mic drop moment. And I do have one last question. And it's just why and where people could find you if they want to go see your work online.
Yeah. So I'm on Twitter and LinkedIn and most other social networks, Threads, as at J Casabona. That's J-C-A-S-A-B-O-N-A. Reach out, say hello. I'd love to hear from you.
I said that was the last question, but when you said your last name, Casabona, and spelled it out, is the second half of that bona a word in and of itself?
Yeah, Casabona translates from Italian to good house. So nice. Yeah, my friends would call me Joey Goodhouse in high school and college.
Yeah. So one of my roommates in college was Casa Grande. That's what triggered that for me.
Yeah. Very nice. Yeah. Yeah.
You can imagine what his nickname was.
Yeah. People in high school would replace the A with an ER in my name because high school boys, you know. No offense to your listeners.
For sure. 100%. Yeah. No, I appreciate it. This has been really incredible. Thank you. And until next time, just keep putting out awesome stuff and doing you, because it's really been cool to see and now cool to create with you.
Awesome. My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me again. This is great.
Thanks. Boom. Now I need to put that in my Airtable.
Woo.
JKL listeners, thank you so much for being here. I'm having a ton of fun making these episodes recently, and I hope that they're getting better and better as well. It would mean the world if you passed the show along to friends or family that you think could also benefit. And thank you to our guest today, Joe. If you're looking for tips on automating your podcast, how and when to outsource your content creation, monetizing, or the creation of a show in general, his work is first class. As always, we love getting your DMs or comments about the show. If you have any input on guests or topics, please don't be shy. Just let us know. Until the next episode, all the best. And remember, just keep learning.